We're picking up the story of Moshe and his encounter with Paro. Starting from chapter 5, this is after Moshe meets up with his brother Aaron, and he conveys to him everything that took place, the entire discussion. Then it says that both Moshe and Aaron went, and they gathered together all the elders of the children of Israel. It would seem that at this point in time, it's important to bear in mind, because we'll see in the next parsha, where God instructs Moshe again, he gets another message to go to the Jews, and it says that v'lo shamuel Moshe, that they didn't listen to Moshe. So it seems, generally speaking, that his initial appearance to the Jewish people, Moshe dealt with the elders. That's in keeping with what we discussed at the burning bush, that Moshe asked about the name of God. Then he asked, indirectly, he asked for signs so that he could establish his credibility, of course, as a prophet of God. It would seem that at this point in time, he really wasn't dealing with the masses of the people, and that he dealt with the elders. The elders would be their wise men. And so Moshe and Aaron went, and they gathered. That's in 4:29. They gathered the elders of the Jews. And it says that Aaron said all of the things that God had said to Moshe. This is also extremely important over here, because what bothered me, if you take a look further on in the next parsha of Va'era, and we'll fill in the missing blanks, because a lot takes place between what happens over here and what happens in the next parsha. As we've already learned, the initial meeting with Paro could be described as a disaster. There was a setback, a significant worsening of the situation. And that leads Moshe to, so to speak, complain to God. And that's pretty much where we left off. We're going to be coming back to that. And what was the answer that God gave him? The story continues into the next parsha, which is Va'era, where seemingly God has a new message for the Jewish people. Now, on the surface, superficially, it may seem to be similar to the original message that he gave to the elders, but it contains more detail, more information. And it takes up a number of sentences. It's in chapter 6 that he's to convey to them that his name, the name of God, a name in which he did not appear or make himself known to the patriarchs, but he will make himself known to the Jews with that name, and that God has established a covenant with their fathers to take them to the land of Canaan, and that he's also heard their screams, their affliction, and therefore tell them that I am the Lord, and I will remove them from the burdens of Egypt, and I'll save them from the enslavement, and I'll redeem them with a mighty hand, and I'll take them unto me for a nation, and I will bring them to the land that I lifted my hand in as an oath, swearing that I would give it to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I'll give it to them as an inheritance. I am the Lord. So this is a pretty lengthy message. It's more detailed than the original one. And what happens is that Moshe delivers the message, and the Jews did not accept it. If you take a look at 6:9, the Jews did not accept it. One wonders, well, what happened? It's an interesting kind of a pasuk. It says that Moshe spoke thus to the children of Israel, and they didn't listen to Moshe. Mikotzer ruach, from a shortness of spirit, umeavoda kasha, and from hard work. We'll return to this pasuk. It's interesting. It just tells us that they didn't listen to Moshe, whatever that means. It would appear that they didn't accept the message. They didn't accept it. But it also gives you the reason. Superficially, it seems to be that they were simply too downtrodden. The spirit, the first words referred to the spirit. The ruach means spirit. And sometimes, in order to be able to hear something, this was a radical message, obviously. It's a very significant message. And it's not in line with the kind of state that they were in, but you just have to have a certain amount of room, so to speak. Sometimes a person can reach that state where, from a psychological standpoint, emotionally, you just can't hear certain things. You have no... I guess people can have that in a relationship sometimes. That at a certain point in a relationship, let's say things are going badly, but if the other person makes an attempt to explain and to appeal to you that they're going to change and so on and so forth, so you can give them a hearing, you can listen. You have room within your heart to consider the possibility. Sometimes you have room. That doesn't mean you're going to accept it or reject it. At least you have a certain amount of room you can consider. You're willing to listen, to think about it, to consider it. After all is said and done, you may reject it. But here it says they didn't listen to Moshe because of shortness. They just didn't have... Sometimes you reach a point, I can't hear that. That is, you may have been disappointed with somebody so many times that now that they want to make a certain appeal, that they've thought it over, they're going to change, you just can't even give them a hearing. From a psychic, you're closed. You're too narrow, and that, it's not necessarily a criticism. It's a reality. And I think that's what the first part means. And the second part is simply from the hard work, labor. That too has a impact upon a person. In terms of the physical wear, you're too weary. So in order for a person to be able to give a proper hearing to a complicated kind of a message, they have to be in the right condition physically. And that's a good thing to know, by the way. Of course, we learn from everything. Even indirect lessons we learn. You should prepare yourself. This is not what I'm not saying the pasuk is coming to tell us this, but since it does tell us what it tells us, that the Jews could not listen to the message due to these extraneous factors. It doesn't say because there was anything wrong with the message. It doesn't say there was anything wrong with Moshe. Even though, as we'll see, Moshe Rabbeinu apparently thought that there was something wrong with him, that he had not delivered it correctly. But no, it's telling, the Ramban points this out. The Ramban says that they didn't accept it, not because they didn't believe in God or in his prophet. Rather, because they couldn't pay attention to his words because of this shortness of spirit. As one whose soul is very, very short in his labors. Well, he goes further. He says, and he doesn't want to live another second in this kind of pain. It's sort of a lack of, you run out of all kinds of patience. Seems the way he's describing it, that you just don't have the patience. Anyways, the point I was making is that this should not be ruled out. That sometimes you have to present something to somebody else. You should realize the nature of your message and what it would require in terms of the other person. That is, when is the best time? What state of mind do you need in terms of the other person? So sometimes you'll have a better hearing. Sometimes you won't have such a good hearing. So you should bear that in mind, and you could be wasting your energy if you get the other person at the wrong time. It is conceivable that had that person been rested and in a good mood and so forth, you sort of try and, to the extent that obviously that you, that it's possible, you don't always have control, but you want to aim for the right setting and the right mood on behalf of the other person. That there, it is conceivable that something failed, a presentation failed, under different emotional circumstances it might have succeeded. Nevertheless, as we said, it seems that Moshe interpreted it as something to do with him. Because at the next sentence, it says that God spoke to Moshe and said, go and speak to Paro, king of Egypt, that he should send the Jews out of his land. And then Moshe said before God, behold, the Bnei Yisrael, the Jews, did not listen to me. And how can Paro, how is it to be expected that Paro will listen to me, and I am uncircumcised lips? That's a reference to a speech impediment. He's not trained in terms of the speech. So it would say, it would seem that Moshe took the fact that the Jews did not listen. He didn't see the real cause, but rather the fact that he was lacking in his ability to speak. Now, when I first read this pasuk just recently, what bothered me was, why should Moshe be having this kind of problem? Well, it seems to be a repetition, a rehashing of the issue, that he's not qualified because he's not a good speaker. That's true. And once you mention that, it's even more difficult to understand, because it seems that that issue had been redressed when God said that Aaron will be your spokesman. So if Aaron is going to be the spokesman, I assume that he's the one that's doing the talking, so then this whole issue should have been put to rest. And Moshe's objecting that he can't go to Paro, or it wouldn't be good to go to Paro because of his speech impediment. How will Paro listen to him? Again, it seems to be rehashing an issue that's already been resolved. And he has Aaron as the spokesman. However, if we go back, in light of that, we can understand the significance of a comment that's made by the Ramban. If we go back now to chapter 4, verse 15, in which God describes for Moshe the new arrangement that Aaron will speak. So it says, then you'll speak to him and place the words in his mouth, and I will be with his mouth, with your mouth and with his mouth, and I will teach you, I'll instruct you what you should do. Seemingly, this appoints Aaron as the one who's going to be doing the talking. However, it's not that simple. It's not that simple that everything that would be said only through Aaron. As the Ramban points out, that I will be with your mouth to teach you, to instruct you what you should say to Paro. Because, he says, at this point in time, God only meant that Aaron would speak for him to the people. As it says, and he will speak for you to the people. That's in verse 16. V'diber hu l'cho elo'am. He will speak for you to the people. And he will be for you as a mouth, as a mouthpiece. And you will be for him as a god. And so on. Now the Ramban takes that to mean that it is only with reference to the people that Moshe would not have the obligation of speaking directly. Aaron would speak for him. But as far as Paro is concerned, that's a different matter. Now, you might wonder, why would it be a different matter? However, the Ramban continues, however, with regard to Paro, Moshe would speak. And he says it makes sense. It appears that this would be because of honor to the king. That is to say, it might be, you see, there were many factors that had to be taken into consideration in Moshe's dealings with Paro. There's many factors, psychological factors, diplomacy factors, and so on. Because it's not going to be miraculous that you just appear in front of Pharaoh and do whatever you want to do and it's going to work out. It had to be conducted according to the ordinary rules, according to the laws of nature and so forth, the laws of reality. So apparently, the Ramban is saying that it wouldn't be respectful that you're going to go to the mighty king to beseech him with a message, and you're not going to speak to him. It's that that could be construed the wrong way. And it could be construed as disrespectful. Who are you? You're too high and mighty that you are on a higher plane. Apparently, Paro spoke for himself. He didn't have people speaking for him. Now, for you to say, sit in the background, he's my spokesman, he'll talk to you. That could be demeaning. Paro could be insulted. Wouldn't be correct. So it would seem, according to the Ramban, that when God said that he will appoint Aaron as your spokesman, it's not that simplistic now, that the whole thing is settled and it's just Aaron is going to be doing all the talking. No, it's just going to be, he's going to be helping you out. But it doesn't mean that you're not going to do any of the talking. And at this point in time, it was only with regard to the Jews, and Moshe had to speak to Paro. This is an important point, because it enables us to understand a number of things that would become difficult. For example, later on when God instructs Moshe to return to Paro and to speak to him, so then Moshe's comment makes sense when he says that I uncircumcised lips, that the Jews didn't listen to me, and how am I going to speak to Paro? Well, it makes sense, because if Aaron was of no avail in that situation, he couldn't utilize Aaron in that situation because of this issue of respect, so then we understand it. Now, the Ramban makes this point. The Ramban had this point in mind, obviously, because he, continuing now in the Ramban, on 15, he says, and in the end, Moshe returned and said, behold, I am uncircumcised lips, and how will Paro listen to me? So Moshe picked up on this point, that he considered it to be a liability. Moshe considered his speech impediment to be a liability and an impediment to the success of the mission. And then he says, the Ramban says, then God gave permission that he doesn't have to speak to Paro. Now, as far as it would seem then, to summarize, what about the issue of respect? It would seem that that was necessary at first. At the outset, it was necessary that Moshe speak. It would be perceived as disrespect. But once Moshe did speak, and once Paro, that's also part of the development, that in the course of the meetings and the negotiations, Paro develops a tremendous respect for Moshe. Then it no longer became necessary. Then it became, or it could be that it's clear that Moshe doesn't like, he's not a speaker, he doesn't like to speak, he has a speech defect, so Aaron does the speaking for him. At a certain point in time, it would be okay for Aaron to do the talking. So that's the significance of the point over here. We'll see if we can work it out. It's not 100% clear that Moshe never speaks and Aaron does the speaking. That seems to be the general plan, which is that, especially in the meetings with Paro, that Moshe will be, so to speak, like in the place of God, which means God will communicate to Moshe the word, the message. And Moshe will then tell it to Aaron, and Aaron will function as the prophet. He'll convey it, obviously, with his own words and so forth. He will convey it to Paro. That's the general plan. Does this mean that that Moshe Rabbeinu would never ever speak, would never say anything? I don't know if that's the case. And we will see. We're going to explore that to the best of our ability. Because it could be that in every meeting there was a specific message. This is the word of God, so to speak. Yeah, but then after that, there was probably discussion. Paro's reaction, and then how they answered. we're not maintaining that every word of the discussion was coming from God to Moshe to Aaron. It means that at every meeting with Paro, Moshe came with a message. That message was from God. That message was delivered by Paro. It's sort of like the way negotiations are conducted today, even, that the president can have a message. He sends through an emissary to someone, to a world leader. So then the emissary comes and he reads, let's say it's in the form of a letter. He reads it, or he just communicates it. This is what the president wanted you to know. He gives the message. Now the other one has the message, and then he starts to talk. He reacts, he asks questions, and you answer those questions, whatever you feel you can. Well, what's the significance of this? What's the significance of that? That is the job of the emissary. So here too, the Torah is not really describing all the details, but you will see in many of the encounters that after the initial message, Paro asks Moshe questions. Why can't you serve God? Okay, I'll give you permission to serve God, but why can't you do so in Egypt? What do you have to leave Egypt for? And Moshe has the answer. His answer being that we can't do that because that's considered an abomination for the Egyptians. That if we'll worship God by slaughtering the sheep. And the sheep is something that they regard as a deity. So, I don't know that we have to assume that Moshe never opened his mouth. And that wasn't really the nature of the complaint. The nature of the complaint, as we understood it, seems to be that if Moshe has the full burden of the communication, then he feels he's going to fail. Because these are delicate matters. And somebody has to have smoothness, articulate. That is to say, not to have any defects and inhibitions in the realm of speaking that would really hinder the mission. That doesn't mean to say that there's no point at which Moshe can speak. So therefore, it's not clear when it describes Moshe saying these words and so forth. Does that mean Moshe got the message from God, but the actual speaking was with Aaron, or did Moshe speak himself? We'll have to see the extent to which we can clarify things like that. Getting back now to the quote-unquote complaint of Moshe, it appears that after the setback, there was a setback, and Paro retaliated for the request in a very harsh way by seeking to undermine the credibility of Moshe and the entire idea that they would serve God by accusing them of laziness. He accused them of laziness. He did not give any credibility to the notion that they had legitimate rights to serve God and anything along those lines. Apparently, they thought that there was a point in going to Paro, and that Paro might relinquish to some extent. But Paro's reaction was extremely harsh. To the contrary, they suffered. And the suffering of the Jews increased. It got worse. And it also undermined the credibility of Moshe Rabbeinu, because he was the individual through whom it came about. So that seems to be the basis. Even though Moshe Rabbeinu knew that the Exodus would not come about, certainly it wouldn't come about immediately, God said that I know that Paro will not listen to you, unless with a strong hand. So Moshe knew that already. And he was not expecting any concessions as a result of this. But there's different commentaries on this. But what makes the most sense to me is that Moshe was completely taken aback, completely surprised by the fact that the situation got worse. And indeed, the way the Torah describes it, what triggered the, so to speak, complaint was the fact that the Nogsim, those were the foreman had gone to lodge a complaint with Paro. To a certain extent, sidelines, secondarily, you do get a sense of the naivete of the Jews. That is, that the Jews apparently did attribute some type of a justice to Paro, because after they received the beatings, because it was an impossible task, they were placed in an impossible situation. you could see the increase in terms of the labor, in terms of the anxiety, to be given a burden, to be under constant pressure, and knowing all the time you really can't fulfill the amount. There's different kinds of pressures that people are subject to. Sometimes you have a busy day, you have a lot of things to do, you don't have a break, you don't have a minute. But that's one thing, you can more or less deal with it, but you don't have any free time to get involved in something else, and it's hard work, and you'll be tired at the end of the day, but you're in control of the situation. Other times you feel overwhelmed. There's 1,000 things to do, and you're totally overwhelmed, and you don't have enough time to do it, and you have this feeling the entire time you're not going to make it. And there's different kinds of pressures. The second one, of course, is the more serious one. It creates a state of anxiety, and the person can start to panic. People say, and when you, that itself becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because then you start to panic, and then you're not productive. You can't, you're not making correct decisions, and one thing leads to another. It seems like that's the situation the Jews were put into. That he put a crushing burden upon them, which pretty much they couldn't fulfill. So you're going to run around looking for straw, and then have to get back, and all the time you're doing it, you're overcome by this feeling of despair. That you're not going to be successful, and you get beaten in the end anyways. Which really creates a sense of hopelessness. So that seems to be the basis for the complaint of Moshe. Let's take a look now. It's at the end of Shemos. And it happens right after the encounter with these foremen who really lash out at Moshe. Which is another important point. Apparently, Paro calculated this. That instead of being angry at Paro and recognizing this as outrageous, they redirected their anger against Moshe. And they complained, "Let God judge between us, in that you caused our..." It's an interesting expression, "Hivashtem esrechenu," which means you made putrid our odor, which conveys the sense that you cast us in a different kind of a light. Whatever standing we had or whatever respect, they've lost any kind of respect for us. And gave them a sword in their hands to kill us. As we look at it, it's hard for us to understand the words of the Noksim as though they had some kind of standing. They were slaves. Paro didn't respect them. They were slaves. It's true the situation got worse, but don't delude yourself. It would seem that they're in a state of delusion, and they're getting angry with Moshe Rabbeinu. Because, well, as far as that's concerned, they're right, it seems. They're right. The Jews were in a bad situation. I guess they had made their peace with the enslavement, and it was manageable. They could deal with it somehow. So you see, even in the most trying situations, people have a way of adapting to it. Apparently they adapted to it. Part of that is the adoption of a slave mentality. That's what happens. That's really the worst aspect of the entire thing. And that's a crucial element in the whole Exodus story, that certain things were done to extricate the Jews, not just physically, but from the slave mentality, which of course is much worse. And you see some of it over here, that the anger is against Moshe Rabbeinu, who did not make an unreasonable request. You see the people joined together with him, and they went to Paro, the elders. It wasn't unreasonable that we're a nation, we're working hard for Egypt, slaving, and we have to go serve our God. So why is that so terrible? And the tremendous viciousness of the response of Paro. But when you have that mentality, apparently, then you sort of look back and it was stupid of you. Blame yourself. It's a blame yourself mentality. It's really blaming yourself. But when you blame yourself, you're going to blame Moshe because you went along with Moshe. Anyways, then Moshe returns to God and he says, why have you brought evil? Why have you made it worse? For this people. Why have you sent me? What's the connection between those two thoughts? So Rashi seems to say that he sort of said that, why have you made it worse for this nation? And if you say, that is, Rashi's putting these words into Moshe's mouth. And if you say, what's it my business, so to speak? What difference does it make to me? Meaning, what's it my concern? So then he says, I'm complaining that you sent me. That is, what is the point of sending me on this mission, which only made it worse for the Jews? So we said that, first of all, Moshe Rabbeinu, as the leader, has a right to understand certain things. That in order for him to function and be successful, he had a right to ask the questions that he asked at the bush, at the burning bush. What is your name? What should I say? How can I prove? And so forth. He needs to understand the mission. So this is an unexpected development. It's something which was unexpected. Moshe clearly did not have any thought that matters would get worse. And this was a surprise to him. God did not tell this to him. One wonders, why didn't God tell it to him? The Ramban goes so far as to say that Moshe thought, he knew that the redemption wouldn't come right away, but as soon as he started the process, things would get easier. According to the Ramban, Moshe thought that things would begin to get better. But even others say, others learn simply that Moshe did not expect a worsening. You don't really have to say that Moshe thought that things would get better, because it makes sense even if Moshe didn't have any thought at all. Let's assume Moshe didn't even think it would get better. But clearly he didn't think it would get worse. God did not tell him that it would get worse. And one wonders, why didn't God communicate that to him? So therefore the worsening, and it's not just the worsening, but the impact that it has upon his mission. That, then it becomes, so to speak, his business. He has a right to ask, because how is he supposed to deal with this? The effect it's going to have is it undermines his position with the Jews. It undermines everything. It undermines the religious teaching. If the people now have this attitude of hopelessness, of despair, and as a result of it, they don't regard Moshe as being legitimate, it's clearly going to undermine his legitimacy. Because isn't that what the Noksim were saying? Let God judge between us? Meaning to say that this couldn't be from God. How could it be from God? And therefore, it's you. That's you're doing this on your own. It seems clearly that it's undermining Moshe's very claim to be the prophet of God. If this is from God, so then how could it be such a failure? So for all these reasons, he's questioning, why did you send me on this mission, which was a failure and makes the task so much more difficult. In chapter 6, which is the last pasuk, chapter 6, verse 1, that's the last verse of the Sedra of Shemos. And God said to Moshe, now you will see what I will do to Paro. For with a strong hand, he will send them forth. And with a strong hand, he will drive them out of his land. Okay. But where's the answer? All it's saying is, it seems to be saying that you'll see. It's going to happen. If you take a look at this pasuk, then there's no further answer on this. This is the answer from Moshe. What is the meaning? What's the sense of the answer? Does it mean that God wasn't going to answer him and just simply saying, don't worry, you'll see? That's the way we would speak sometimes. Sometimes if somebody complains, why hasn't this been done, and this hasn't happened yet, and so on and so forth. People are getting anxious because I guaranteed that something would happen in the business, and so on. And they're waiting, and it doesn't seem like it's changing. So sometimes I'll say, you'll see. That's not an answer. That's not an answer as to why it didn't happen until now, or why this was done or that was done. That's merely saying, you'll see. In such a case, what I would be doing would be just reassuring people that certain things are going to happen. Don't give up. But I wouldn't be answering. So the question is, what's 6-1? Is there an answer over here? Or is it just a reassurance? You'll see. The only word in the verse which gives some indication, we have to use a little bit of imagination over here, because it's not being spelled out. But God is saying, Ata, now. Now it can happen. To me, now implies that it wasn't ready, that it couldn't have happened, that which took place had to happen, and now we can proceed. Which indicates that all of this, the fact that Moshe would go to Paro with the elders and make the claim and be rejected, not just rejected, that itself wouldn't have been a problem, as we've seen. The worsening of the situation apparently was part of the plan. But we have to try and figure out how so, why so, why is that necessary? That first it'll get much worse in the manner in which it did. It seems to me what I'm going to try and explain is that the worsening of the situation was necessary, precondition, was a necessary precondition to set the stage for what's going to be happening. The general purpose of what's going to be happening, it's spelled out a number of times that God has made Paro stubborn or God hardened his heart in order to increase his signs, that there's a purpose over here, that God is going to make a demonstration, there's going to be a manifestation of the existence of God, and it has purposes that are significant, of course, for the Jews, but not just for the Jews, but for the Egyptians as well, and by extension, of course, for all of mankind, as we will be reading in subsequent chapters, V'yadu Mitzrayim Ki Ani Yad Hashem. At Egypt will know that I am God. And this is stated that the Jews, God has different purposes. That the Jews, when Moshe gives his next message outlining the details of redemption to the Jewish people, so he speaks about the reaction that it's going to have for the Jews, in terms of the Jews. And he says, this is in 6-7, in the middle of the verse, and I will take you to me as a nation, I will be unto you as a God, Vidaitem, and you will know, Ki Ani Hashem Elokeichem, that I am the Lord your God, who takes you out from under the burdens of Egypt. That is, they're being prepared for the phenomena that they're going to witness. They have to be prepared intellectually, and they have to be able to recognize as a result of all this that all this comes from God. That there's no other force, there's no other factor. This is a teaching experience for the Jews. For the Jews, it requires a level of knowledge, of understanding, as a result of which they are going to be transformed into the nation of God. And for the rest of the world as well, not the same degree, for the Egyptians, that they should recognize God. And they should give up idolatry, they should keep the Noahide laws. They're not under the same obligation as the Jews. But the objective was for the Jews to set them up as a nation and for all of mankind. This was the moment, the only time in history when God would manifest himself in this way, in this manner. It seems to me, therefore, that it's in that context of achieving that objective that now you will see. In order for that to work, in order for that to be successful, for example, the foundational event of Jewish history is the Exodus, which we recall twice a day. We say it in the morning, we say it in the evening, in the Shema. That is, because of the fact that God took us out of Egypt, that's the basis for our acceptance, recognition of God as the creator of everything. And the basis and the reason why we have to serve God, why we're the people of God. I just want to say at the outset, because I don't want to lose track of this point, there are different levels of interpretation, rabbinic statements, which seem to be criticizing Moshe for complaining, which indicates perhaps that Moshe didn't have sufficient faith, quote-unquote faith, and that when things went backward, he complained. So Rashi brings down this idea, so to speak, where God, so to speak, bemoans the loss of the patriarchs who had this quality of faith, that they never complained when things went contrary to their expectations. And it quotes Abraham. They endured. The patriarchs were people who endured these types of setbacks, and they weren't deterred from it. And ostensibly, Moshe Rabbeinu, here we are, you have a setback and you're complaining. That's what they say, but I don't think it's meant to be taken in a literal way. We have to be cognizant that Moshe Rabbeinu was the greatest of the prophets. Nobody is perfect. They're a human being. It's true. Anyone can sin. But it's very, very difficult for me to say that they criticized Moshe and they did not regard him as having the requisite amount of faith. That's very, very difficult. You look at all that Moshe went through, all the difficulties that he had to go through in terms of the Jews and how many times he was tested by them and so on and so forth. So, nevertheless, they say these things. I'm just briefly going to give you my quote-unquote take. This is just my own, and take it for what it's worth. I don't think that's the point. I think it's a midrashic phenomenon. That is, they're not sitting in judgment over Moshe, which nobody really can do. And they're not making the comparison. For example, my question, are they saying that Moshe would not have the same faith? He wouldn't do, if God told him to sacrifice his son, so to speak, like he told Avraham, that's one of the examples, that Moshe wouldn't do it? I don't think they're making that kind of statement. And again, Moshe Rabbeinu reached a higher level of knowledge of God and of prophecy. That in and of itself doesn't make the point, because it's two separate things. One's level of knowledge is one thing. One's level of personal perfection could be a different thing. So here we're talking about the degree of faith. So it doesn't automatically follow that Moshe would be on a higher level of faith or more perfected. However, I still maintain that there's no need to take it that way, that Moshe is being criticized over here as lacking in faith, especially if the situation warrants a complaint, so to speak, or if not a complaint, if you don't like that word. I mean, Moshe Rabbeinu apparently has a right to ask about these things. And especially if we say that it was the problem, his problem was not that Paro didn't give in, but the worsening of the situation creates an animosity against Moshe Rabbeinu and undermines his mission. So for those reasons, it seems that he has a legitimate right to ask the questions. However, I think what they mean is that this is another dimension. There is a benefit. The fact that the situation got worse before it got better. And I'm not saying this is why it had to happen, but it's certainly an addition. You know, you have primary reasons why something happens, then there can be secondary reasons or secondary benefits. I think, though, that there is a benefit in the fact that when we serve God, it's a fundamental of Judaism, we don't connect. There's no attitude of triumphalism. That is to say, the success, the practical successes of an initiative in and of themselves do not in any way confirm the truth of your religious idea. That idea of triumphalism, all the religions have that, that if they're victorious and they win, they take over, that proves that we're right. That is an absolute falsehood. At the same time, the fact that you're defeated, that you're downtrodden, that failed, that the Jews are in exile, and so on and so forth, in no way, shape, or form is any indication whatsoever of the truth of the ideas. That's the... So, the fact that this is the correct idea, that we have to serve Hashem, that's the truth. And I think that's why they're depicting that as though, comparing it to the Avos, to the patriarchs. That the patriarchs, in their situation and their circumstances, they had to endure many of these types of disappointments where practical circumstances seem to go contrary to what they one would expect, given that they were doing so many things to serve God, and why would these things... And that didn't bother them. They were not troubled. So it's merely saying that here too, I don't think it's a criticism of Moshe, but it's making that point. That the fact that you went to Paro, that was the right thing to do, and from a practical standpoint, it led to a worsening in no way, shape, or form. From an ideal situation, that should not bother you. A person of true faith, meaning his faith, I don't mean a blind faith in which you just believe without any question, a faith that's rooted in firmness, in conviction, in understanding, in knowledge, is going to remain just as strong no matter what the consequences are. That is a fundamental point which we can derive from this. And I think the reference over here, they're referring to it that way, just to bring out that point. I want to proceed now to a non-Midrashic approach. And what would be the reason? We are not told the reason for the worsening. So, as I said, we can try and use our imagination and understanding and see whether we can come up with anything. What might be the reason? Now, it seems to me, again, it's my suggestion, that it's in line, one has to understand the goals. There's an objective over here. And the objective is that people will see the hand of God, quote unquote. And that this is akin to creation. What the miracles that will take place, the events that will take place, will not just demonstrate the existence of God, but the relationship between God and the existence of the universe. And that is what we call creation ex nihilo, creation from nothing. That God is the absolute master over the creation. And therefore God has the power to change things around, to nullify the existing laws of nature, the splitting of the Red Sea, and so forth. All that is going to come about, it's going to be manifested through the deliverance of the Jews. Ultimately, it will be the fact that the Jewish people, the downtrodden people, the people of slaves, were able to be extricated from the mightiest of kings. In order for this story to resonate, the stage has to be set. It has to be made clear to everybody the absolute desperation of the situation of the Jews. There's a number of different factors. The absolute weakness and impotence of the Jews in the situation. The absolute power of Paro and his determination, the type of king, that he's an absolute ruler, and this we'll understand now, God hardens his heart, that he's an individual who's unyielding. In the same way, I guess, in modern times, I don't think anyone who studied Nazi Germany and Hitler, the kind of person he was, would imagine that he was amenable to any kind of compromise when it came to the killing of the Jews. This was achieved by the fact that they went to Paro and they put forth a rather reasonable proposal. And indeed, I think it explains something else I mentioned, that all along the Jews never asked, as people make a big mistake. People assume that Moses came to Paro and demanded the freedom of the Jews, the release of the Jews, which is just not true. At no point does he ask for anything more than an opportunity to serve God, and we'll come back and the ideas will be slaves. He never speaks out against the enslavement. So that's a complete misnomer. In point of fact, we'll have to explain. Did Moshe have a... It seems that he fooled them. He faked them out. That eventually, with the killing of the firstborn, he drives them out and so forth, and they never come back. And then he chases after them. What do we do? Was it legitimate for the Jews to use deception? That's not bothering me right now. We'll get back to that. But you do see that that too was calibrated. The request that you should make from Paro is one which is very, very minor. It's not a big thing. It's not a big deal. So from all of these things, you see that there is absolutely no way that this could have come about in a natural kind of a way. Had the Jews gone to Paro, and from the outset, there would have been a positive response, whatever the case may be, if things would have started to change from the outset of the negotiations, then people would have said, you know, we were stupid. We should have... A lot of times you have that feeling. Sometimes you feel intimidated, you feel weak. You'll say you're working at a job, and you're working very hard, and you feel, you know, you really should be getting more, but you're afraid to ask, and if you do ask, you know, in your mind, they're very, very stubborn, and they won't give in, and they can get angry with me. So you're afraid. A lot of times people don't get ahead in life because they're afraid to ask. So let's say, for whatever reasons, sometimes you have no choice, you're being pressured, or you're being emboldened, or let's say you get another offer somewhere else. If you get another offer somewhere else, that's better, so now you're not nervous anymore. So let's say you were to go and make a request and so forth, and you see a pretty good response, whatever, maybe they don't give you everything, whatever the case is, you could walk away with a feeling of total surprise. Look how stupid I was. It's not so bad like I imagined. I should have done this a long time ago. Now you have a totally different perspective, because your original perspective was based upon your insecurity. So you felt insecure and intimidated. I mean, there's no question that's a big factor in life. That does hold people back in general. It's a side point, but very often people do not get what they are entitled to, what they could get, because they're insecure, they're intimidated, and if they were to move properly, you'd see that you could go a lot further. I'm just using that by way of description, that if there'd be a positive reaction and things would get better immediately, then it would leave the notion that we had overestimated the brutality, the tyranny of Paro, and that there was room, that things could be achieved through negotiation. To the extent that people had the thought that things could be achieved through negotiation, to that extent they would detract from the miracle. And indeed, we say that in the Haggadah. That at the outset, had we were slaves to Paro in Egypt, and God redeemed us with a mighty hand, and that had God not taken us out, then we and our children's children would have been slaves to Paro. That's making the point. It's not just enough that God took us out, but what was the nature of the situation? Was it a situation which was amenable to negotiations, historical change, circumstances, factors? People had to be convinced that it was absolutely impossible for the Jews to leave. If that is the case, that it's impossible, they reached a point where they would have said the only thing that'll take us out of here is a miracle. That was vital. This was true not only for the Jews, but for the Egyptians as well. Because there's no question that the word of what happened, the fact that the Jews went to Paro, and the new decree spread throughout Egypt. It says that everybody knew what was going on. And the slaves had to chase throughout Egypt trying to get straw, so that would spread the word. Why did they suddenly need straw? Oh, because the situation got worse. Why? Because they asked for permission to serve their God. So the situation had to reach a stage of absolute hopelessness. to the extent that they got angry at Moshe for even that, you made it worse. It's impossible. To the extent that it was not viewed as hopeless, to that extent, it would detract from the perception of what was happening as the hand of God. That's extremely, extremely important. Because phenomena were going to occur. But nothing of the phenomena occurs, and intelligent people have to interpret it intelligently. Because it's not magic. All of a sudden everybody wakes up and we all know that God exists. I mean, that's God. When God reveals himself, he produces certain phenomena. And with certain circumstances and so on and so forth, and you have to make an intelligent assessment and a decision. So therefore, these are the factors which need to be in place. From another standpoint, from the standpoint of the Jews, as I said, the phenomena have a number of different objectives. On one level, the recognition of God, that all of mankind should recognize God. The recognition would come from the fact that this miracle, this was a miracle. Because the Jews were in a situation in which, from any ordinary standpoint, it was an impossibility. As the rabbis say, no slave had ever freed himself from Egypt. There was no weakening in their position. To the contrary, it was an absolute determination not to give in. From the standpoint of the Jews, as we said, it was more than just the recognition that God exists, but a certain attitude that they had to have, a certain gratitude. That's the theme of the Seder, is to praise God, to thank God, and as a result of this, to become the people of God, to become the special nation. So there is this extra dimension of gratitude, obviously gratitude, because you're the recipients, you're the beneficiaries, that God did all of this for you, to secure your freedom. And why to secure your freedom? So that you would use this freedom to serve God. That's the real purpose of the freedom. Therefore, this was essential from that point of view. That even though momentarily it produces distress and anger against Moshe, but there's different types of miraculous interventions. I could illustrate it. Sometimes you could see that when you need a big favor, you're in a very, very tough situation. And somebody comes along and does you a tremendous favor. There's a difference. Let's say it has to do with getting a job that you needed or something along those lines. There's two different kinds of cases, two possibilities. Sometimes you have tremendous gratitude to this person, but you don't view it that it was without you, I would be dead. You helped me tremendously. You have that a lot in business. Where somebody comes along, gives you a tremendous opportunity. So you're very grateful, but you don't believe that if this had not come along, you'd be finished forever. There's other possibilities. Maybe you wouldn't have been as good. Maybe you wouldn't have been as quick. So I owe you a lot. I'm very grateful to you. But that doesn't mean that without you, there'd be nothing. But then there's a situation where you feel gratitude. Without you, I was dead. Where you're in a situation where you're absolutely dead. There's nobody that can help you. All of the doctors have written you off. And somebody comes along with something different, unique, and is the only one, and if it wasn't for you, I'd be dead. That's a completely different relationship. That is another point. That's for the Jews. That it had to be made clear that it's not only that God is doing this great thing for you and helping you out and so on and so forth. That's one kind of a miracle. That's one kind of a victory. But no! Without this, we would be slaves and our children. This was something which was entrenched and could not be broken in any other way. So we owe everything to God. That's, in my opinion, the Atta. Now the situation is ready. Now the circumstances, now the backdrop, now the background. All of these things had to happen. And I would say one more thing. Because part of Moshe's complaint See, Moshe, if you take a look at it now, the structure of the wording in the pasuk, Moshe says two things. Why did it get worse for this people, and why did you send me? So there's two things he didn't understand. Why did it have to get worse, and why would I be associated with this? Could have gotten worse before I came onto the scene. I just want to point out that if you'll take a look at the rest of the pasuk now you will see what I'll do to Paro. For with a strong hand, he'll send them, and with a mighty hand. You see, now the strong hand. That is now the fact that I'm going to use a strong hand. I'm going to demonstrate. All of this will have its impact now. Because all the circumstances necessary for people to recognize the strong hand have come into the picture. So we've explained the first part so far, that why this happened to the Jews. As far as Moshe is concerned, but why Moshe? Why did Moshe have to be associated with it? Things could have gotten worse without Moshe's being associated. I was discussing this with one of my students, and he said that I had answered this question years ago, and he said he had it written down in his Chumash, and he told me what I asked, what did I say? And he said that I had said that, you see, it's necessary for Moshe, that a person can't be a true leader until he's experienced the rejection of the people. That this is a benefit for Moshe Rabbeinu as well. And by experiencing, in order to be a leader, there is a natural desire of a leader not to be unpopular. So you see that this bothered Moshe as well. The rejection, the anger. It's a difficult thing on many levels. It's not, Moshe was the humblest of people. The average individual feels bad because of his ego. He doesn't want to be disliked. Moshe Rabbeinu was the humblest, so I'm not saying that that's what bothered him. But everybody, even a humble person, does not want to be the cause of somebody else's pain. You're always concerned, maybe I did something wrong, I don't want to bring... And therefore, this can have an effect upon you. That is to say that there'll be cases where, just like a parent with a child, because of your fear that they're going to be upset with you and so on and so forth, this can corrupt, so to speak, your judgment and prevent you from being completely objective. And a leader has to be on a plane where he's completely extricated himself from being influenced by that factor. How will it be perceived? By the factor of unpopularity. The true leader has to not deal from the standpoint of the desire for popularity. That's a factor that every leader has. It propels him. Now, that doesn't mean that he's going to distort the situation. He deals with it. A good leader recognizes it. He would like to be popular, but he tries not to allow it to influence his decision too much. But it's there, and it will influence. And very often of different possibilities, different courses of action, which all of which may make some sense, he may be drawn towards certain courses of action because inwardly he feels more comfortable with it. He feels more comfortable with it because already he can anticipate the unpopularity of certain things, and doing the unpopular is very difficult. So I do think that that's possibly another benefit to Moshe. Now you will see that it was important. To the extent that it's very difficult to comprehend why this should happen through you and make you unpopular, the answer might be that that's part of the training of a leader, to experience what would be considered a setback in terms of the popularity of the people and work it through. Work it through and deal with it and uproot all of those factors that are operative in your mind in terms of needing the approval of the people.